Well, that was
another number from Kate McClurkin. But I've got something very exciting, a real treat. I'm so happy to introduce Lynette Marlowe to you all. Morning, Lynette.
Morning. How are you?
Lynette, I was stunned yesterday. I went to the Arala Centre for the NAIDOC Week flag-raising ceremony, and there you were, guest speaker.
Yes, I was asked by the Arala Centre to speak. I'm a lecturer at the UNE,
right.
First Nations lecturer, and I'm studying my PhD at the university. So my PhD is in Ngarrabal placemaking.
So the Ngarrabal is a tribal group of First Nations people.
Yeah.
From around this region.
Yeah. So around Glen Innes to Tenterfield.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also taking into account Yukumbul, which is around the McIntyre River area, Quambul, which is up around Ashford, and Gambul, which is just over the border around Texas.
Right. So it's an area that in we sort of tend to stick in the high country in our thinking, but you're going to stretch us in a sense, going further west to the northwest part of our region. Yeah.
So this is my research is, I think, the first time in modern history that we've really looked at that high country area, that northern New England area.
Right.
And I've got 14 elders. Some have passed away, but 14 elders that have signed up to approve my research.
Wow.
So the Girikiri elders at Inverell, big shout out.
Yeah.
And the Severn River Ngarrabal and Quambul Aboriginal Corporation have really sponsored me with my research.
And your research is focused on those communities and...
Yeah, and most of those elders have lived in that area all of their lives.
Right.
Or for the majority of their lives. Yeah. It's just to get those elders together is an amazing feat in itself.
Mm.
They should have given me a PhD just for that.
Just finding all those people and bringing them together.
Yeah. I'm very well supported.
Yeah. So, look, your own family history is a kind of, what could you say, it's emblematic, I suppose, of what's lying just under the surface, isn't it?
Yeah, so last year, Uncle Theo Wright, who's one of the elders from Tenterfield, and I wrote a paper for the Glen Innes Historical Society about the Windeyer Blacks. So the Windeyers were a very famous family, especially... Non-Indigenous family.
Non-Indigenous,
especially
right.
Especially so that they came to Australia in 1828. They owned a property at Tamargo down in Newcastle. They owned a property at Purfleet, around Taree.
Mm.
And then they ventured up north to New England.
Mm-hmm.
So Deepwater Station is one of their areas.
Mm.
And we worked for them. So they really gave us protection through all of that protectionist and that protectionist era. So one of the projects that I've been working on at the moment is going to the UNE Heritage Centre.
Right.
And going through all of the station records and finding out what Aboriginal people worked for different stations. So I've just gone through the Campbell records of Inverell Station and the Deepwater Station records, and I've got a large collection of names from those stations, which is really important because, you know, we were part of the New England settlement. So... The invasion came to northern New England very quickly, within 3 years.
I remember reading the history of New England when I couldn't sleep one night, and I couldn't sleep because it was so interesting, but one of the features of that was it didn't make sense how quickly the so-called white invasion happened.
Absolutely, and Callum Clayton Dixon brings that up in his recent publication on the New England massacres, you know, and surviving New England. In northern New England, it actually, I think, happened quicker than southern New England. I worked with Uncle Theo Wright on the stopping to stop the Mole River Dam.
Mm.
I came up here, I think, 2020, at the beginning of COVID, and the New South Wales government had said that they were going to start this Mole River Dam, and that they were going through the business analysis of all of that. And Uncle Theus was in lockdown in Western Australia.
Right.
And most of our elders were in lockdown, and Uncle Theo told me to get into, you know, in the high country. So I moved to Armidale and started my PhD, and we ended up at the Senate inquiry on the inquiry into dams for the New South Wales Senate. And I had...
You're talking about the federal Senate or the upper house?
The Senate inquiry in New South Wales.
Right, okay.
So so we're in the Senate inquiry, and I remember Uncle Theo saying, no, we've got to face these ministers, face-to-face, these senators face-to-face. So we got in there, and I completed a lot of research that wasn't brought up about massacres that were done on the Mole River. And
So for listeners who don't know, the Mole River is in
Tenterfield, around Tenterfield area, and it goes, that waterway goes into the Jimmerick and ends up around that waterway around Boobera Lagoon. So very sacred area.
I've got my own experience with Boobera Lagoon and how sacred that is.
That is a really, really sacred area. So
that's up north of Moree. So for people that don't know, once again, Boobera Lagoon's just between sort of Moree and over the border. Near Gundawindi.
So saving the Mole River was really important for that whole, catchment area. However, at the same time, it's that area is really significant to us because it's got a huge massacre site, plus there's an Aboriginal reserve there, plus there's a... Aboriginal man by the name of Mole River Jackie. So when the massacres were happening, one of the perpetrators took one of the children and raised him from the massacre. And we believe that that's most probably Mole River Jackie, and he's buried on that site. So we really fought against that dam, saying that, you know, the Mole River was really sacred to Narrabul. Anyway, in June 2022, the New South Wales government decided not to go through with the dam. So I continue with my PhD. The Mole River Dam is one of the sites that I'm looking at with my PhD. I'm also looking at Gunnywiggle or Sheep Station Gully around Inverell.
Right.
So around Inverell, I'm really looking at that, how the elders have proactively placemate. So, you know, engaged in really being proactive activists in that space where they've negotiated with New South Wales Parks and Wildlife and New South in the local government area, you know, to keep that area. So the elders in Inverell were moved to Gunnywiggle around the 1930s.
So this is part of this protection era.
This is that part of that protection
moving Aboriginal
era.
People from the traditional country into sort of enclosed. I mean, it's shocking when you think about it now, but they were called missions, but they were basically concentration camps in a sense.
Yeah.
In the same way that the South Africa.
Absolutely. So the difference with Gunnywiggle is that we didn't have a mission manager there.
Oh, interesting.
And now they've set up, and if anyone wants to go out to Inverell, it's an amazing place because they've got sound trails there now. Sound trails are a GPS geo-mapping device, so you put down stories of that place onto your phone, telephone, and the elders tell their stories as you walk around the different parts of that community.
We have one in the Central Park here talking of in relation to the Aboriginal relationship with the Catholic Church in the very early days here.
It's really amazing. I think it's a lovely way of getting out of storytelling, telling our stories. So some of those elders have passed away, but we still go out there, and it's a lovely...
And you can hear their voices, literally.
We can hear their voices. And it's a wonderful time of reflection. you know, survivors.
Gets you goosebumps.
It really does. And just being in place and listening to those stories and feeling the energy of that place, you know, you can just, it's almost like you step back into time. You're almost like there. Yeah.
It's extraordinary. I mean, you're here because there's a NAIDOC Week celebration on, and the theme for NAIDOC Week is Keep the Fire Burning, Black, Loud and Proud. But, I mean, I mentioned earlier that Greg Strong, who also gave a speech yesterday, talked about local Aboriginal elder and highly respected person right across our community. Greg talked about the work it takes to keep the fires going. And you're doing so much of that work, I suppose, in your and recording those stories and basically making them come to life so that future generations actually understand our history.
Yeah, well, it's not... When I'm lecturing, it's quite... a lot of the students that I'm lecturing, that are in my class aren't... you know, they didn't see our struggles. And I think yesterday we were... after my speech, we were speaking about, you know, the struggles that we had, especially as women 30 years ago, working in that Aboriginal space where, you know, the reflection or, you know, people wanted to work with men. Can I say it like that?
Yes, you can say it any way you want.
And, you know, there were very few... women that had gone to that, you know, in that upper management type area, and at that.
So we're talking about the world of Aboriginal affairs, I suppose. To
yeah, not just the world of Aboriginal affairs, but I think society. 30 years ago, it was a very different society.
Yes, I think it was. There weren't many women leaders, and there were glass ceilings everywhere.
Everywhere.
And if you had if you decided to have children. Basically, it was, in practical terms, you either looked after your kids or you kept your career going, but you couldn't really do both. Because the working hours were fierce and competition. I mean, I was in the legal field and competition was fierce, and if you weren't there and deals were done between 4 and 6, which...
yeah.
Or four and on, 4 p.m. and onwards, and if you're having to race back to wherever your child's in daycare and then feed them and... whatever. Yeah. You've missed it. You're not there.
And for Aboriginal women, it was even harder.
Yes,
you know,
I can imagine.
Because we weren't in that space.
No.
And, you know, so yesterday we were talking really about the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission. And because I worked for the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission with Treaty.
Which was the last time that we had something like the voice that
the
was...
Parliament.
Some kind of an independent leadership body that represented exclusively Aboriginal people. And
So I worked at ADSIC for 7 years right to the end. So my cadetship was with the Community Development Employment Projects, which was one of the first projects that was dismantled by the Howard government.
And the CDEP program, which it was known as, was something that... was basically work for the correct me if I'm wrong, work for the dole.
Yeah.
But in Aboriginal communities it had a huge meaning because for some people it was the only way that they could get a job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it really meant that we had community infrastructure too.
Yes.
You know. So that was one of the projects that the Howard government started dismantling ATSIC with. And at the time I was working on treaty, so we developed the treaty information and awareness strategy.
It's amazing to me to know that treaty project was, it's not really amazing because, I mean, I've always known about treaty, but it was started so long ago and it's still an ambition. It's not realised.
Yeah.
You know,
I think it was an ambition right at the beginning of colonisation, know, because... when you go to the foundations of colonisation, Australia wasn't settled properly.
No,
settled without consent.
I know, and for example, I know that, I mean, I think we've actually got some common colonial ancestors, but we haven't really discovered that yet. But I know, for example, that there was a deal done by, I think it was Arthur Phillip, but I'm not sure, the first governor, that they would that the white settlement would stay off out of the Hawkesbury.
Yeah.
And they didn't.
So Watkins Tench was the first surveyor in 1789. Mm. He went down to the Hawkesbury to see Yarramundi and Goomorrie.
Mm.
So
and these were Aboriginal people.
Yeah, Aboriginal, high-ranking Aboriginal people. They were the chief, what we would call in white terms, in modern terms, should I say,
yeah,
as a chief. So when he went into country, he was met at that border with the guides, and the guides, and this is all documented in his journal, so the guides told him how he could walk into country, where he could travel, you know, and this was a protocol that we did for most of Australia. You know, that we had these boundaries, and
you had to get permission.
And we had to get permission to go into country.
But permission was not withheld unreasonably. It was a complex system of reciprocity, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So at that time, the government cannot say that we did not have laws and governance. And that was actually...
So it was a big, fat lie from the outset.
From the outset, it was a big fat lie.
Yeah, I know it was, because we're sort of having a fresh conversation here. But I did some research in the Q Records Office, and I read the original reports of Phillip back to the Foreign Office, and he knew every single location of different Aboriginal people all around Botany Bay and all around Sydney Harbour. And he wrote back, because the English at that time had a great interest in natural history, which is the way they saw it. And so there's absolutely no doubt that there weren't detailed notes going back to Mother England about the complex laws and governance around Aboriginal behaviour and peoples.
In the Boswick records at the Mitchell Library, there's vast amount of records about really early settlement.
Mm. But then, getting back to Watkins Tench.
But anyway, so then, I'm working on the film around Pemaway, who was the first warrior around Sydney. And he was murdered in 1802, and his head was decapitated. And then his head was sent over to England, so we're trying to get Pemaway's head returned.
So that hasn't happened yet?
It hasn't happened yet.
Mm.
And, but then, you know, a lot of people don't know that there was a war. So Lachlan Macquarie proclaimed war in Sydney against the tribes in 1816. Mm. So there was a huge war in Sydney, and I transcribed the rules of war. You know, it was horrific. Lachlan Macquarie said to hang us up on trees, and they basically gutted us. So we were hung up on the trees as a deterrent to other First Nations people, and then we were gutted, and just walking through those places in Sydney, it's just it's horrific to know the history of Sydney. But we stood strong. So in 1836, Jack Congo Murrell killed another Aboriginal man around Windsor. Mm. So we're talking about Boorabarrongal country a few moments ago. So Windsor's around Boorabarrongal country.
Mm.
And he said that the laws of Britain and Ireland had nothing to do with him, that he was under the native laws of Australia, and that was thrown out of court.
At 1832, there was a declaration of a separate legal system.
Yes, absolutely.
In a legal format.
Yeah, it was thrown out of court. So I always stand by, you know, what he had said, and I understand that in Australia we have, you know, as a First Nations person, I live under a different set of rules. I have to live under these two set of rules, I think that's one of the things that I tried to bring up yesterday in my speech, is that that's why we need a treaty in Australia, because we need to sort these really early issues about colonisation and our, and I think that's part of our nation building, and you know, we need to look at that framework that of what our nation was built on.
That's right. And the fact that, I mean, some of the listeners will remember the expression terra nullius, which was what was used in a very early colonial case, pretty casually, but it became latched onto the it's a Latin term meaning empty land, meaning that there was no need to recognise Aboriginal sovereignty or law or land rights or anything back then, because the country was empty, devoid of humans. I mean, clearly a lie.
That was also a lie, because Bennelong, in the Wakan Tench papers, Bennelong says, Bennelong, who's an Aboriginal man who went over to England, he said that Mimal Island was inherited to him. It was his island. So, you know,
it could never have been fairly... these were clearly deliberate deceptions.
Absolutely.
Perpetrated. Fascinating. And it does fit into that theme of keep the fire burning. And as Greg Strong was saying, the fires of research, the work that needs to be done to look at the past and bring it back into sort of the public domain, so that the whole nation understands what happened and, you know, how we can build a future together.
Yeah, and it's about that two-way learning, about re-educating. And I think South American education philosopher Paulo Freire talks about how First Nations people all over the world, Indigenous people all around the world, need to explain what their culture, what their histories are about, so that there's a wider understanding of, you know, where we're coming from. You know,
and it's interesting putting the onus, in a sense, back on First Nations peoples to tell their story.
Yeah, and that's the importance of this truth telling. You know, and and to tell a story.
It's amazing.
But we've come up to the end of our discussion.
Oh, we didn't have very long, but I'm so, so grateful to you, Lynette, for coming in and starting the story. I knew there was a big story there, and I don't think it'll be the last time we'll be talking, but thank you so much for coming in today.
Okay.
And we just wish you a very happy NAIDOC week.